So Stephen asked right before, wait, what did you ask? Is it written anywhere? So two things. First of all, the topology is somehow, so Kirby calculus definitely is written. I mean, Google Kirby calculus, you'll find books and books about it. The algebraic side, so this sort of meta-monoid stuff is written in only very, in those two places that I mentioned. But you know, you should see it as an opportunity, not as a handicap, okay? It means, you know, if you want to write it, you can, okay? I'll be happy to cooperate. Okay, so the next two things I wanted to talk about is about genus and about ribbonauts. So first of all, about genus. So let me, so there is this theorem which says that every knot can be presented, well, I'll just write it, can be presented as the boundary of an embedded surface orientable surface in R3, and then the genus of the knot is okay. So we'll say it, let me say it this way. If K is the boundary of a surface sigma, which is of genus G, then I will say that the genus of, so let me call the genus G0, okay? So then I will say that the genus of K is less than or equal to G0. And the genus of a knot is the infimum of, or the minimum of all genera of surfaces whose genus is K, okay? Whose boundary is K. So this theorem is due to Seifert, and such a surface is called a Seifert surface. And first of all, let me prove the theorem to you. The theorem is easy to prove, okay? So start from a knot, and I always start with the same one, so the trefoil knot, but the proof will be general, okay? And of course, it is oriented, and then do a part of what is done in the Jones polynomial. Namely, every place you see a crossing, replace it by the smoothing that preserves the orientation. So for the Jones polynomial, you do something complicated in exponential time, but for the Seifert surface, you do something which is linear time, you something very simple. Basically, you replace every crossing by the smoothing that respects the orientation of the knot. So if I do it for the trefoil knot, I will get, well, here I will get this curve, here I will get these two curves, and here I will get these two curves. The result always will be a union of cycles. So So maybe I should have sort of not erased the knot. So starting from the knot, I get this picture. And so each such cycle you can present as the boundary of a disk. So this will be the boundary of this disk. And well, so if the cycles are nested, just push the inside of the outer cycles to be behind. So the outer cycle will bound a disk which is behind this one. Okay? So, in fact, I could have simply pushed all cycles to be behind, okay, and just pushed them at different amounts, so then each cycle would look like a coffee cup coming from behind, or equally well, I could have done it from the front, a coffee cup coming from the front, from behind, and then the bigger cycles will be just bowls of coffee, you know, will be the extra large cups, and then this one will be the small cups, okay? Well, that's not yet the thing whose boundary is the knot. To get the thing whose boundary is the knot, what you do is you connect each of these lips of cups with a twisted band. So you add a twisted band between this and that. And I could have added a twist in either direction. So basically add a band. So I could recreate either type of crossing by adding such bands. Again, the picture is, so if you have two cups, if they are side by side, maybe you want to show. So if you have two cups side by side, what you do is you glue a piece of paper, a band, to this one. You twist it and you glue the other side to the lip of the other cup. Now, if the cups were nested, it just doesn't matter, because I don't even see that, right? I only see the vertical part of the cup. I don't care if one is inside the other. Right, if that had gone that way, it just doesn't matter. Okay? Anyway, by doing this, for each of the, well, you get a surface. And it's easy to check that the surface is orientable. Namely, each of these disks had a boundary, and the boundary is oriented. But if the boundary is oriented, it induces an orientation of the disk. In this case, they are all oriented the same way, but it doesn't matter. I mean, all of these discs are orientable, and you can check that the gluing of the bands will respect these orientations. This is exactly the fact that I've used the orientable smoothing everywhere. Okay? That's it. QED. This one is actually a complete proof. Okay? Okay. So, claim. Okay, so let me define a map. Let's call it, what should we call it? Well, I'll call it tau, but later, no. Tau is, well, theta. Okay, theta for thickening. Theta begins with TH. Okay? So let me define a map theta, from tangles with 2G components into tangles with one component, which really means knots. Okay? And my claim will be that the image of theta is equal to the set of knots of genus less than or equal to G. So this is knots of genus less than or equal to G. Okay? So genus is definable in terms of the map theta. So here's how the map theta is defined. So the input is a tangle whose connectivity is 2G pairs of, 2D, two, well, a caravan of G double hump kennels. So 2G pairs of components that are connected this way. Okay? So that's T. And the map theta maps such a tangle to, so again, remember that when I draw things like that, I really mean that these can be noted in an arbitrary way. I'm showing them schematically, but they could be noted in a complicated way. But even if they're noted in a complicated way, I can double each one of them. So I can double the first one, I can double the second one, I can double the third one, I can double the fourth one, okay, and I can double the rest, but I will not bother. So now I have these bands, and the bands are noted with each other, okay? But now I connect strands in pairs as I am showing right now. And if you look at it, you get a single connected component, right? If you trace with your finger, so I start here, I go this way, that way. Oh, sorry, to here, to here, to here. Basically, if you trace with your finger, it's a single connected component. So this is a tangle with a single strand, meaning it's a knot. Okay? Also, this knot is visually the boundary of a surface with genus G. Namely, the surface is just, okay, so close it to a knot, and the surface will be this coupon, this band here, union all of these bands, and it's easy to check that this is a surface of genus G. Okay, this is basically, you can compute the Euler characteristic, or there are many ways to see it. Okay? So what I've shown is that the image of theta is contained in knots of genus less than or equal to G. And it's actually not so hard to show the other inclusion, but I promised you to show only the only one direction in each implication. So it's easy, but I'm not showing it. Okay? Now, finally, theta can be written as a composition of meta-Hopf algebra operations. Namely, I double each of the G strands. So, I mean, if I wanted to write it, it would take me some, it would take a few lines, okay? But schematically, what I do is I apply the doubling operation 2G times, and after that, I do the stitchings. How many stitchings are there? Roughly 4G stitchings. So I roughly stitch 4G times. This is approximate. Okay? Now you could write it precisely, but it doesn't really matter. The point is that theta is expressible in terms of meta-Hopf algebra operation, which means that there is an analog of image of theta inside any meta-Hopf algebra. So you can write the image of theta inside any meta-Hopf algebra. And whenever you have a meta-Hopf algebra morphism from tangles into some other meta-Hopf algebra, the image of knots with genus less than or equal to G will be inside this algebraically defined subset of the target meta-Hopf algebra. So in principle, you get a way of telling whether a knot does not belong to this image. sorry, is not of genus less than G. Right? Because if its invariant is not in this algebraically defined subset, then it cannot be of genus less than or equal to G. So, okay, so that's the third example. And then the fourth example is Ribbon knots. And by the way, this actually works. In fact, you actually get obstructions for a knot being of small genus by applying this machine, okay, with some specific invariants. Okay, the next one is Ribbon knots, and maybe I should first define Ribbon knots. And I think one definition of Ribbon knots is look at the web page of our class. And, you know, maybe I should just access it again. And there is this picture that appears in it. And it appears in it because it defines Ribbon knots. So a Ribbon knot, so a knot K is Ribbon means that it is the bound that it can be presented as the boundary of an immersed disk. So a disk which is embedded, but it's embedded with singularities, so it's immersed. If it was straight embedded, so a knot which is the boundary of a disk which is embedded straight is the unknot. But I'm now allowing singularities with ribbon, so-called ribbon singularities, but no so-called clasp singularities. And I think the best way to understand what these mean is to see a picture. So here the knot is in red. The disk is shown as a blue membrane. So the blue membrane here is a part of the disk. And a ribbon singularity is a singularity which appears like here. And it's the singularity that you see when two ribbons pass each other in such a disk perpendicular way. So basically, you have a line of singularities whose endpoints are maybe the picture simply explains what it is. Okay, so. Maybe I'll say more. So what does this look from the perspective of the parameter space of the disk? So from the perspective of the parameter space of the disk, so here is the disk. It's parameterizing this blue membrane. And a line of double points becomes a pair of lines in the parameter space. Right, but basically that same line as viewed from the horizontal direction, from the horizontal part of the membrane, or as viewed from the vertical part of the membrane. So that same line from the horizontal part of the membrane looks like a line from an inner point to an inner point. So it looks like a line like this. And from the perspective of the vertical part of the membrane, It's a line from a boundary point to a boundary point, right? From red to red. So from the other inverse image of this line in the parameter space looks like this. So this is a ribbon singularity. And a clasp singularity, so again, a line of singular of double points will have two pre-images, but now from the perspective of the left membrane, this line is a line from a boundary point to an interior point, and from the perspective of the right membrane, it's again a line from an interior point to a from a boundary point to an interior point. So this is a clasp singularity. It corresponds to a pair of lines that look like this. Okay? So it's not too hard to show that every knot bounds a disk containing clasp singularities. But some knots also bound disks which are which contain only ribbon singularities. Example, well, the knot shown here in red. Okay? And then there are many others. I think there are 19 or 21 or so knots, ribbon knots, with up to 10 crossings. So out of the 250 knots with up to 10 crossings, 19 or 21 are ribbon knots. Or maybe 18. Now I'm confused. But some small proportion. Okay. So one particularly interesting question about ribbon knots is the following. So maybe I'll first define something else. So definition, a knot is a slice, it's called a slice knot. So if you can do the following. So first of all, think of the three-dimensional sphere as being, as sitting as the boundary of, as sitting as the boundary of a four-dimensional ball. So it's sitting inside the four-dimensional ball. Now, suppose you have a knot K living in the three-dimensional sphere, you may or may not, so it's here, so K is living here, you may or may not be able to find a disk living here such that the knot is equal to the boundary of the disk which lives here, But with the disk living, with an embedded disk like this. So a knot is sliced if you can find a two-dimensional disk embedded into the four-dimensional ball so that the boundary of this disk will be your knot. So it's a bit hard to draw, but drawn one dimension down, so if this is B4, then a knot is sliced if you can find a disk whose boundary is this knot, but the disk should be non-singular. Okay? So it's easy to show that a ribbon knot is sliced. So, claim, ribbon implies slice. Proof, so basically take your ribbon disk, take this blue membrane, and push it
down in the fourth coordinate. So push it, if you wish, into the four ball. So push this membrane a little bit into the four ball. But push it so that the amount by which you push is proportional to your to the distance from the boundary. So in other words, when you have a rebound singularity, the horizontal membrane gets pushed more than the vertical membrane. So therefore, the singularity disappears. In the four ball, all of these intersections disappear. Okay? So ribbon knots are automatically sliced. And then there is a long-standing open problem, so open since the 60s, is if the other implication is also true. So if ribbon is equal to slice. And currently I think most people believe that this is false. So the conjecture is that some slice knots are not ribbon. Okay? Now, to prove such a conjecture, well, you need a potential example. And potential examples exist. So people can write down specific knots starting with 48 crossings, which are known to be sliced and are not, and it's not known if they are ribbon or not. So nobody had shown a ribbon surface, but maybe there is one that nobody found. And when you're talking about a knot with 48 crossings, it's very hard to imagine what a ribbon. I mean, it's not something that you can do with your imagination. So basically, we need invariants that will be able to show that a knot is not ribbon in order to disprove, to prove a counterexample to ribbon equals slice. Okay? So then comes the next theorem. Okay. So again, I will define some maps, and then like theta, and then state a theorem using these maps. So suppose you have a tangle T, which belongs to the space of tangles with 2n components, and the 2n components are organized in the following way. So first one goes up, the second one goes down, the next one goes up, the next one goes down, and so on up to up and down. And then one map will be the, well, what I will call tau. No, how do you write tau? Tau. So tau is the tangle closure of this tangle, and it's a tangle with n components. So what you do is you, okay, so this goes into Tn, and it acts by you close all of these components at the top like this, and only at the top, okay? And then there is a second map into, so let me call it kappa, and kappa is a map into tangles with one component, meaning knots. And what you do is you take your 2n strands and you close them, instead of at the top, you close them at the bottom.
Okay? And furthermore, also at the top, but with a shift of 1. So, you know, maybe I should have drawn one further component, or one further triple pair. So at the bottom, you close like this, and at the top, you close with a shift of 1, which means that you have 2 free ends, so you just send them to infinity, and that's a tangle with 1 component. Okay? Now, and you can, and this has 1 component at the end. So, claim, so theorem, a knot is ribbon if and only if for some n you can find there is some tangle T inside tangles with 2 n ends such that a knot K is ribbon such that the tau closure of T is the unlink, the untangle inside Tn, and K is the kappa closure of T. So what's the untangle? The untangle is, well, actually the thing that I drew here. So the untangle is, well, the thing with n components that are not linked in any way, or said differently, you have n components that bound n half disks that are embedded. So something like that. Okay? Good. So, as per policy, I will only prove one direction. So I will prove that this direction. So if there exists a tangle, then the knot is ribbon. Okay? So suppose you have a tangle with the property that when you close it at the top, you get the untangle. Okay? So I close it at the top and I get the untangle. The fact that I get the untangle means that it bounds a disk. So I get a thing which bounds a disk. Or not a disk, I mean a union of half disks. Okay? But the picture is misleading. Namely, so you get a disk when you consider. Okay, first of all of these things might be knotted with each other. Okay? So the disks might not look so simple-minded. And furthermore, you get a disk when you think of it as a tangle inside a bigger disk. Okay, when you think of it as a tangle whose boundary is only the stuff at the bottom. So, right, once I closed it, then I'm thinking of it as a tangle in a bigger, inside a bigger, sort of, whose picture is drawn inside a bigger disk. So these disks need not look like that. They might be very complicated. I mean, they might have, parts, I don't know, tubes that come out and move around in space. And in particular, parts of these membranes, parts of these membranes might be passing in between, well, in various places in space. Okay, I have no control where. Okay? So maybe I should try to draw a better picture.
So I have my two components. They bound half disks, but these half disks, these membranes, might have might have pieces that pass in various complicated ways, even above the so all the knottedness is happening here, but in order to unknot, you might have to go above. So these disks might go above the location of the original tunnel, the placement of the original tunnel. Okay. Now, Now let me tell you how to switch from the tau closure to the kappa closure. Okay? So first of all, I close at the bottom, and closing at the bottom, I close at the bottom, and this is happening outside of the mesh. It's happening below the mesh. So I can simply extend each of these disks into a little bit further. And now instead of n half disks, I have n full disks. Okay? But now at the top, I have the wrong type of closure. Right? I have this closure, but I want to go to the shifted closure. So what I do is I connect these two things by a line. Now, this line is actually drawn above where all the knotting happens, so it's drawn here somewhere. Okay? So I mean, it has a canonical a priori known shape. I'm drawing it this way. This is a correct drawing. However, this line might intersect the membrane might intersect these disks, because these pieces are pieces of these disks. However, I can still take this line and double it and replace it by a band, by a thin band. Okay? And now it intersects these disks with rebound singularities, because I could have assumed that the intersections were transverse, and then every transverse intersection the line gets doubled and it becomes a rebound singularity. Okay? And what surface do we get? The surface that we get was, well, before it was two disks, but now I connected them by a band, so it's a single disk. And the closure has switched from the original closure to the shifted closure. Okay? And if I have more components, then I just continue doing the same. So connect these two with a thin ribbon too, and again it will work. Okay? Good. What time is it? Oh, 5 minutes. Yeah. So, there is a small number of further things that you can define. I didn't even say the punchline. So the punchline is that kappa and tau are both compositions of the operations that we have. So basically, if you had, well, maybe I'll just draw this diagram once. So basically, we have T to N mapping via tau to T N and via kappa to T1, which is really naught. Now, suppose you had an invariant Z, which was a metamonoid morphism into some algebraic space. So you'd have A to N here, AN here, A1 here, and Z would map this to this, this to this, and this to this. And furthermore, since tau and kappa are compositions of metamonoid operations, namely that both of them in fact only involve stitchings. So since both of them are just compositions of stitchings, and since the target space is again a metamonoid, you'll have a tau operation here and a kappa operation here. And maybe I could, just to distinguish them, this is the topological tau, this is the topological kappa, and this will be the algebraic tau and the algebraic kappa. And this diagram is commutative, and the fact that it's commutative is the fact that the invariant that I wanted was a metamonoid morphism. Okay? And now, okay, in tau n, there is a specific, in tangles with n components, there is a specific tangle called u, the untangle, and it gets mapped by our invariant to some specific value in an. So I don't know, if this is the topological untangle, its image will be the algebraic untangle. So, you know, presumably, if these would be polynomials of certain kinds, then that might be the polynomial one. Or if these are matrices, then that might be the identity matrix, or something very simple-minded. And then, ribbon knots, so the set of ribbon knots, by the theorem over there, is equal to the union over all n of kappa topological applied to tau topological inverse of the untangle. And you can check that it follows from the commutativity of this diagram that Z of that is contained in basically apply Z naively to the right hand side. So the union over N of algebraic kappa of tau, sorry, of algebraic A inverse of U A. So you can call this thing the algebraic ribbon knot space. And what I told you is that if K is ribbon, then Z of K belongs to this space. So now suppose I wanted to prove that some knot is not ribbon. I would compute its Z, and if it's not in this space, I win. And then I could potentially find a counterexample to the ribbon slice conjecture. The only problem, okay, the problem is, well, so in principle, so this is a method of proof, but it might be that R sub A is everything. Okay, and if it's everything, then I'll get the empty condition. Okay? But at least I have a handle on a proof. So if I had more time,
I would start going over the handout that I really gave you, and the main part of the handout is one particular calculus, which I like to call gamma calculus, that which is really a meta Hopf algebra along with an a morphism of tangles into it. But I suppose this will happen next time. So let's stop.